Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with 4 Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. This episode includes graphic content that may not be appropriate for all listeners. Trey Kay here, and from West Virginia Public Broadcasting at PRX, this is Us and Them, the show that tells the stories about the things that divide us. Documenting the world around us has never been easier. The proliferation of smartphones and cameras of all kinds allow us to record almost anything, even violent crime. There is excruciating video of George Floyd's murder. There are images of Ahmaud Arbery's fatal shooting. And future generations will be able to see each horrific second of these murders. But in 1970, when police opened fire on crowds in Augusta, Georgia, there were no cameras around. During a protest turned riot over a brutal murder of a black teenager, 6 black men died from police bullets. But the Augusta riot was never referenced in a police report. Local media coverage downplayed the police violence, accusing the protesters of escalating the conflict. As a result, the story of that riot remains relatively unknown to many city residents, white and black. Cece DeChuro was teaching at a university in Augusta when she learned about the riot. As a journalist, she was fascinated that there was so little known about what happened. She wanted to establish a record of events. And in 2020, shortly after the killing of George Floyd, she did just that. That research and reporting produced a 6-part radio documentary for Georgia Public Broadcasting. It's called Shots in the Back, Exhuming the 1970 Augusta Riot. I talked with C when we met at an award ceremony in New York City, where she was, well, unforgettable.
At the award ceremony, I got up onto the stage and they handed me my award and I promptly dropped it. the host said that was 10 years good luck, and one of my good fortunes was that you, having noted the name of my podcast and that I dropped my award, decided to come over, and so we started talking.
When C first learned of the 1970 Augusta riot, she was teaching journalism at Augusta State University.
In my position, I was asked if I could review someone's senior thesis, which was on the riot. Interesting, never heard of it. And it was a very biased and I don't think the person intended this, but white supremacist in nature kind of documentary about these crazy black people doing heroin and this riot happening. And
So you wanted to kind of dig in and some things didn't seem right, and you kind of wanted to dig in and kind of see for yourself?
Yeah. I saw a story that was being told just from the perspective of white officialdom, and one lone black voice who was being blamed for it all.
It's valuable to think back on the social and political climate of the country in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
This is May of 1970. So May 4th was the day that National Guardsmen killed four white students on Kent State's campus in Ohio.
Those were war protesters, Vietnam war protesters.
Exactly, yeah. War protests were a really big deal at that time. There was a ton of unrest on college campuses across the country related to the Vietnam War. But the civil rights era was still going strong, even though we kind of think it what was dead at that point. It wasn't. So there was a lot of unrest, and in the South in particular, things happened a little more slowly down in the South. So early May, a boy named Charles Oatman died in the Richmond County Jail.
Before we hear a clip from C's podcast and find out what happened to teenager Charles Oatman, a bit of context. When C started this project, she was teaching a podcast course at the Jesse Norman School of the Arts in Augusta, Georgia. She saw an opportunity to bring young people into a story that's relevant to today. So the project became a collaboration between Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Jesse Norman School. And a handful of students worked with C as a part of the podcast. They all went on an interview with Charles Oatman's uncle. And here's an excerpt from that scene.
Oh, we're
on this tree.
Oh, this is really pretty.
Oh, this is really big.
That's Lenton Oatman. He's directing us into Flat Rock Cemetery, where his nephew Charles Oatman is buried. He directs us behind a church to a grassy road, and that leads us into the woods.
Going on back to the end, to the last. All this family, all the way back.
All of this is family.
Huh?
All of this is family.
We've come here to turn this idea of a boy into a person with an actual family. His high school yearbook photo is the kind every mother would want. He looks kind and calm with a sweet smile and flared ears. His eyes are big and they have small pouches beneath them.
I don't like walking through graveyards because I always get sad that I might step on somebody's unmarked grave.
It's Charles Oatman.
Charles Oatman, October 16th, 1953, to May 9th, 1970.
Charles's grave has a plain marble headstone. Next to it are the graves of his adopted parents, Cornelia and Grover Oatman.
There is Cor, what something.
Cornelia.
Cornelia P. Oatman. There's more Oatmans up there. Go, 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 go.
Court records indicate that he was never formally adopted. But I'm using adopted because that's how his family refers to him. Charles had been an Oatman since at least 3 years old. And as Lenton can attest, he has stayed an Oatman in death.
I heard that she knew Charles when he was younger.
Yeah, about 2 or 3 years old when I first got to know him.
Lenton says in 1956 he came home from Alabama to visit his brother. And when he woke up on the couch the next morning, he discovered he had a nephew.
And I was asleep. And when he woke me up that morning, playing with my hair and my face, I thought it was my brother was playing, but it was Charles. I didn't even know they was had a child. And so I stayed all day around that house that Saturday waiting, playing, talking to her. I got ready to leave. He cried.
Charles was Cornelia's only child. Lenton described his nephew as tiny and delicate.
You couldn't holler at him. You couldn't slam a door around him. If you slam a door, he gonna start hollering or crying. That's the way I sense he was. You know, he just couldn't take abusing or being hooked.
He was also intellectually disabled. A court-ordered psychological evaluation stated he had the intelligence of a second grader, though he was attending A.R. Johnson Junior High. His principal at the time told the paper that he was well-liked and not a boy to get in trouble. In the spring of 1970, Charles wasn't the only child in the house. Charles's dad, Grover, had a daughter from a previous marriage. Her child, Joanne Robinson, was 5 years old, and she was staying with the Oatmans. Charles and Joanne spent a lot of time together, including the day that Joanne went into her grandparents' bedroom and crawled under their bed.
I don't know who left the gun up under the bed with the shell in it. It was a gun that had broke the stock. There wasn't nothing on that but just the barrel. The baby went up on the bed and pulling it out.
Lenton wasn't there for what happened next. He found out what happened from his father, brother, and sister-in-law, who heard it from the front porch.
So he had the gun, but messed around and cocked the hammer on it. And he didn't know nothing about no gun. I shoot him one or nothing. And the gun went off and killed the child. And Charles sat there with the baby. After he shot him, took the baby, sat on the floor, and just dropped the baby. He didn't know the baby was dead.
Charles was arrested, and despite not having an arrest record, the judge denied him bail and sent him to the county jail.
And he should not have been in the county jail. He should have been out at Youth Development Center.
That's Grady Abrams. He was one of Augusta's few black city councilors at the time of the riot.
But he was incarcerated with adults as well as other youth there at the county jail on 4th Street.
The district attorney later told reporters the YDC's director had refused to accept Charles, even though they had the space. Sheriff E.R. Atkins told a reporter the jail wasn't safe.
Do you think the supervision is proper in your jail that two inmates could kill another?
Now, we get down to the fact that we do have an old, outdated jail. This was put up in the 30s, and now it is overcrowded.
The jail was designed to temporarily house 50 inmates. At the time of Charles's death, it held 150. A 1966 grand jury had found the jail was filthy and unsalvageable.
That's an excerpt from the podcast Shots in the Back, exhuming the 1970 Augusta riot. I'm talking with producer and host C. Statura. I wanted to hear that excerpt to learn more about Charles Oatman, the teen whose death sparked the riot. But I also wanted to hear that clip to understand about the reporting team, some of whom are teenagers themselves.
They ranged in age from 10 to 17 at that time, most of them being middle schoolers. None of them had heard anything about the riot prior to joining the class.
So here you are, for listeners who are listening, you are a white woman and you're doing reporting on a lesser known incident during the civil rights movement. Were you wanting to make sure that as far as like any bias with regard to race or anything like that, that you were kind of checking yourself?
I took a lot of time. I took several years away from the project and educated myself on Black history and Black culture and on white supremacy and white privilege and white fragility, and had to confront a number of my own demons. I don't think that any of us escape racism.
C also credits her editor, Keosha Howard, who she says is one of the very few Black news editors in the nation. C says Keosha was essential, handling any bias in her reporting. They even recorded a wonderful bonus episode talking more about Keosha's role and how their relationship evolved during the project. Coming up after a break, we'll hear more about Charles Oatman's death in the Richmond County Jail and about the six Black men shot in the back that night in Augusta, Georgia. You're listening to Us and Them.
Our program is supported by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Hey, it's Trey, and you're listening to Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm talking with Cee Stachura about her award-winning podcast, Shots in the Back, exhuming the 1970 Augusta riot. That uprising was sparked by the death of a black teenager, Charles Oatman, in the Richmond County Jail. Here's an excerpt where we'll hear what happened to Charles. Now, first, we're going to hear from Clifford Graham. He was an adult who was held in a different part of that jail. He talks about how most of the incarcerated people would spend their time.
We stayed down there in the recreation room. Gambling, shooting, dying, whatever you want to do, all kind of stuff. You stay down there from 6 o'clock that morning to 11 o'clock.
But that wasn't Charles's experience. Since juveniles weren't supposed to be at the jail, they weren't allowed to mix with adults. Charles was put in a cell with 5 other people. 3 were 16 or younger, 1 was 17, and 1 was a wheelchair-bound adult. That's 6 people in an 8x10 room, along with a television, a sink, and a toilet. Some news reports say the room had 4 beds, others say 8. This crowded cell was where Charles and the others spent 24 hours a day. Clifford Graham says they were never in the rec room, and we know they ate their meals in the cell. One of Charles's cellmates said they had card games and wrestling matches because, quote, "There was nothing else to do but sit up in the cell," end quote. Lenton remembers Charles called him from the jail.
He was just crying and hollering about, "Come, can you, Uncle, come get me?" They beat me up, made me do things, nasty thing. And they burned me with fire, stuff like that.
When he told you that they were making him do nasty things, was your impression that they were raping him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he told me about it one time. They raped me now, and he done making me do nasty things.
Charles also told Lenton that his cellmates were pouring salt in his eyes. He spent 6 weeks in that cell, from March 30th to May 9th, the day he died. Black leaders had long complained that even in a jail known for suffering, black men and boys were made to suffer more than whites. Sheriff Atkins obliquely denied that at the time of the riot.
The charge has been made by some of the black leaders that there's a different set of circumstances for a young black boy who's arrested and a young white boy.
No, we have whites and blacks in the same place down there. In fact, there's whites and blacks in there today.
It's unclear if there were white juveniles in the county jail, but we do know there wasn't 24-hour guard coverage. At least not on its black side. Saturday night, May 9th, Carrie Mays answered the phone at Mays' funeral home. The hospital was asking her to come pick up a body. It was Charles. And when she saw him, she called City Councilor Grady Abrams. I spoke with Abrams in 2012 before he died.
The explanation that she had been given for the injuries on the body just didn't rhyme with what she had heard. And the call was made to me, and she invited me to the funeral home to look at the body for myself.
Mays was told by sheriff's deputies that Oatman's cellmates hit him several times after losing a card game. In the process, he fell off his bunk and no one noticed that he had died. But the marks on his body told a different story.
He had three long gashes across his back, about a half an inch deep and about a foot long. The back of his skull was busted out. He had cigarette burns all over his body and fork marks all across his body, as if somebody had taken a fork and just crunched them all over his body.
Even Charles's face was poked with tiny holes. His buttocks were scraped and covered in cigarette burns. Some of the injuries were fresh, and some were a few weeks old.
As I said, the only explanation was that he was in a card game and he fell off the bunk. When I saw that, I couldn't hold it to myself.
So he took his anger to the people.
I had a radio talk show, and I asked the people to meet me down at the jail, and we would get answers as to what happened to Charles Oakman. Well, when I got off the air and got to the jail was surrounded by police officers. The sheriff had called in all available officers to be at the jail and surround the jail.
News reports said sheriff's deputies were even on the roof with machine guns. Despite that, 300 people gathered across the street from the jail in May Park. One of the people mixing in the crowd was plainclothes officer Lieutenant Tommy Olds. He was one of just 10 black officers on Augusta's 130-person police force. Olds spoke to the FBI and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation at length, unlike a lot of other officers. In a transcribed interview to the GBI, he said people at the rally were ready to storm the jail for answers. Here's an actor reading from the transcript.
They were accusing the sheriff's department of murder. They were accusing them of telling lies and this and that and so on and so forth. And they were in the process of selecting people to go into the jail and talk with the sheriff.
Grady ended up being one of the people who met with jail officials.
And we inquired as to what happened to this fellow. And we got the same answer, that he had fallen off the bunk and had died from those injuries from falling. But unbeknownst to them, I guess, they didn't know that I had gone to the funeral home and had seen the body. Ordinarily, I guess the funeral home people would not have called in anybody to inspect the body. But I got a chance to see that body.
See, this whole thing sounds horrible. It reminded me of the initial reports that we heard about the cause of the death of George Floyd. And at first, you know, there's an excuse, and then someone presents some more evidence. In Floyd's case, it was a bystander who, captured the thing on video. What has your reporting explained about how city bystanders responded to Charles Oatman's killing?
It made absolutely no news when it happened. There was no response initially. And then Grady Abrams, the city councilor, went on a radio show that he co-anchored and told everyone about the body. And people, primarily black people, gathered at the county jail. And the police and law enforcement officials did hear that they were coming to protest and surrounded the jail and also stood on top of the jail with armed with rifles and shotguns and apparently in a few instances machine guns. And after that point, the only thing that changed was that two of the other teenagers who were in the cell with Charles were arrested and charged with his murder. But, you know, it was done overnight, basically between 10 p.m. and 9 a.m.
What, because it seemed as though there were questions that people in the black community were asking and they realized, okay, the story doesn't seem to be adding up. We need to take some type of action. Is that what you're suggesting?
They had just said he had fallen off of his bunk. And what Abrams, as we heard, told people was, no, his body showed signs of torture. So somebody had to have done that. And the sheriff's solution to getting this back out of the public's eye was to say, oh, well, it was these two kids who were in the cell with him.
There's one other just little detail that you added is that Grady Abrams had a radio show. There was a famous person who owned that radio station.
Yeah, right? It was James Brown's station.
Wow, right, because James Brown is from Augusta, Georgia, or that's what he claimed as his hometown.
Yeah, James Brown and an opera singer, Jesse Norman, both came from the same era and from basically the same part of Augusta. And one of the things that Brown really wanted to do was invest in his community to build it up. And at that time, he owned quite a few radio stations, including the one in Augusta.
And in many ways, that was like the connection. That was what the Black community was connected into. And so if Grady Abrams would have gone on to his station and said, you know, something's not right with the death of this boy, Charles Oatman, people became outraged.
Right. That was, if you wanted to know what was happening in the Black community, that was the station that you were listening to. And it was an activist station. There was another host on that station that was, you know, also spoke a lot about Black activism and equality. So what Grady said at the day after Oatman's body was delivered to May's funeral home was, let's go meet at the jail and protest. And then the next day,
somebody's got to answer for this.
Yeah. The next day, the other hosts on that station were like, we are going to go to the municipal building tomorrow, Monday, 3 p.m. Show up. We are going to get answers. So that's the point where people in the community, particularly, you know, Augusta has a historically Black college, and there was a lot of activism at that college. And so there's just this sense of, no, we're not going through this again, where you just tell us this is how it is. We want the sheriff to answer to us. We want answers about why that kid was in the jail in the first place. And when the leaders wouldn't speak to the crowd, things got violent.
I mean, it was just rapid fire all night long. I expected to hear how many hundred people died last night. Rather than six, my expectation was like 600.
University Hospital was flooded with victims. Randy Smith was an emergency room nurse at the time. He says people came in during the riot with bullet wounds and head injuries.
I just remember seeing some whites, old white people, and bleeding, and then all of a sudden, it was almost like no white people.
All of them had left the area by early evening. More than 60 people reported injuries. A third of those victims were white, and the rest were Black.
And the police would just come through and just shoot at them. And then the ambulance people would pick them up and bring them to the emergency room.
Late that night, the scene at the hospital would change again.
We began to see soldiers coming into the emergency room. And they had fixed bayonets, and they were on guard in the halls of the emergency room. And then at one point, I walked out to where the ambulances were coming in, and I saw a M60 machine gun on a tripod with a soldier there.
Soldiers were also lined up outside of Payne College. The campus was a hotspot for civil rights activism, and the FBI was talking to at least six on-campus informants. Most of those seemed to be students, and they told the FBI a small group of students were readying Molotov cocktails and walking the perimeter of the campus.
See, who was the governor of Georgia at that point?
A gentleman named Lester Maddox, who was famous for for kicking black people out of his restaurant by chasing them with an axe handle.
Yeah.
And he actually sold those in his restaurant after that happened. And it was those actions, amongst many other white supremacist speeches, that vaulted him into the governorship.
And I'm imagining when the National Guard was sent in, that Lester Maddox was the one who made that call, correct?
Yeah, he was.
How many people were killed in Augusta, Georgia that night?
So there were six individuals, all black men, all shot in the back, killed by police. Police were carrying shotguns that night, and shotgun wounds were what killed these men. The National Guardsmen did have a heavy presence. They blocked off the black neighborhoods so people couldn't get in or out. And there were about 2,000 guardsmen. There've been a couple reports by both black and white residents of that time that there were other individuals who died or went missing, and that those people who were, again, black, were just put in a ditch or put in the river. A historian I know has said that he's finding some evidence for that, but what we know for sure is that six men between the ages of 18 and about 45 were killed.
So see, it seems to be like a moment during the civil rights movement where in many ways, I think a lot of people are wanting to fulfill Dr. King's dream of, you know, that we want to be equal in this society. And the black community in Augusta, Georgia, basically showed up and were demanding answers to some pretty tough questions. But if somebody in your podcast asks, was it all worth it? Did any change come from it?
Yeah, it is such a hard question. I think it's a question that we ask ourselves today, post George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. And we say, okay, well, look, there was, you know, in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, right, this was a racially motivated murder of a black runner by three individuals in South Georgia. And those three individuals are now sentenced to life in prison. The same, you know, we saw a sea change in the narrative of George Floyd. So, but I think a lot of people would still say, yeah, but those are tokens. Those are token changes. The same thing can be said about Augusta 1970. There are some who will say, yeah, things changed. We got another black individual on the city council. We got another black individual, or actually the first black man, onto the county commission. After a lot of push, we saw the city followed through on its commitment to form a human relations commission, as it was called. It took a lot of effort on the part of black people, but it happened. And in 1972, the county finally went ahead and adhered to the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education integration ruling. So, yeah, but did the people who had been complaining about unpaved roads, about poor-paying jobs, about police brutality, did they see a difference? That I don't think those people saw a difference. In fact, I would say that those people saw their community die a little more quickly after that riot, because the businesses that had remained as white flight had been taking place,
There'd been a lot of destruction subsequent to those riots in the black community.
Right. Yeah. Those businesses disappeared. Right. The shoe shops and the pharmacy and the laundry, the dry cleaning shop. All of those places closed up, and that made it harder for people living in those poor neighborhoods with poor transportation options to have access to a good quality of life.
And those are extremely important things, and certainly important things to note. But I don't think that we can leave this episode without asking the question, was there ever any justice for Charles Oatman?
Telling his story in this podcast was one of the ways that we paid homage to him. There are also individuals who are continuing to do work in his honor. And there's actually a Charles Oatman Memorial Award for individuals who live in the neighborhoods that he grew up in. So there's some stuff that's being done to create opportunity and create a sense of justice for him. But at the time, the two individuals who were in the cell with him, who went to prison for 10 years, started out saying that they were innocent and came out of prison 10 years later, again saying they were innocent. No one from law enforcement was ever charged or disciplined for his death.
There never was justice for Charles Oatman or the six black men who were gunned down. And that speaks to the current dialogue about holding law enforcement officers and correctional staff accountable. Cee Statura says working with middle school students at the Jesse Norman School of the Arts helps ensure that the story of the 1970 Augusta riots has a future. Sometimes when I was listening to your report and knowing that you were working with kids, and then heard some of the violence that was happening, and people being shot in the back, and then, oh my God, I mean, some of the abuses that happened to Charles Oatman, I wondered, what was it like working with these kids? Were you ever concerned about kind of presenting them with this full spectrum? And I guess I'm wondering, did you ever have to split yourself? Like, okay, I'm a journalist here on one hand, and yet on the other hand, I'm an educator, and I have to be careful with regard to how it is to present this to these kids. How did you navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, there were days where I was sitting in our little recording booth handing a student tissues because they were upset about what they were hearing. And I want to be clear, they did not hear about all of the deaths. They heard primarily about Charles, and they heard about how the others happened. But the details that you hear in the podcast, they did not.
Were there questions that they asked that helped drive your reporting?
Yeah. One of those questions, and I kind of alluded to it before, was, does this mean that police are bad? So it informed how I talked about police brutality and I had to learn how to talk about a nuance in a way that was digestible for a middle schooler. And that was a challenge, but I feel like a lot of times that's basically where America is in its conversation about racism.
It just seems like really kind of a remarkable experience that you had.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It took a lot of decompression. Because there were so many variables, so many The story was really being written as, while the reporting, I mean, we had done like 50 interviews and gathered, you know, gosh, like almost 1,000 pages of FBI documents on this. The way that we told it was still so influenced by what's happening now that we can incorporate or that we have to respond to in order for the relevance of this to really stick.
So, Cees Tatura, I'm so grateful to have gotten to know you and your work. And I think this is a really dynamite project. And I think it deserves the awards you have gotten. And I'm just so grateful that you were willing to come in and tell us about it.
Thank you so much for listening and for sharing this. I've enjoyed talking with you. And thanks so much.
You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to Cees Tatura, her team at Georgia Public Broadcasting, and the young people at the Jesse Norman School of the Arts that helped her report this series. If you'd like to hear the award-winning Shots in the Back exhuming the 1970 Augusta riot, we've posted a link to that podcast series on our show page at wvpublic.org. Michael Lipton and Tristram Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and the CRC Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the Mentorship Program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.